Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Ethan Elkind. On tonight's show, we'll continue our coverage of both the COVID pandemic and then the November ballot by diving into the arguments for and against Prop 15, which would reform commercial property taxes in California. But before we begin, I want to encourage you to support KALW during our fall membership campaign. At City Visions, we bring you interviews with creators, thinkers, activists, and leaders who move critical conversations forward. And we're one of the few local shows to invite participation from listeners. We love hearing from you. And if you love hearing from us, please consider supporting the station. Make a one-time donation, or better yet, become a sustaining member. Go online now to kalw.org/donate or call 800-525-9917. Your gifts support the programming you love. And I was just told that we have a $1,500 match this hour. If you donate, your donation up to $1,500 will be matched by our producer's circle contributions of $1,500 of matching funds. The number again is 800-525-9917, or you can donate at kalw.org/donate. Thank you so much. Now, as we have most weeks since March, we are going to begin tonight's show with a brief update on the coronavirus pandemic. Last Thursday, San Francisco announced that it was speeding up its timeline for reopening. After months of waiting, some businesses are finally allowed to serve customers indoors. Here to help us unpack the latest developments and give us advice on what is or isn't permissible under the new guidelines, I'm pleased to welcome back Aaron Alday, health reporter with the San Francisco Chronicle. Welcome back, Aaron.
Thanks for having me back.
And Aaron, since we have you here as a health reporter, I have to first start with the other health crisis hitting the Bay Area right now, and that's all of the smoke that many of us are dealing with, all of us if you're here in the Bay Area or really anywhere on the West Coast. And so what are your sources telling you about the health impact of this poor air quality, and what should we be doing about it?
Well, the second one actually is the easier question to answer, which is we should just be staying indoors and staying out of the bad air, this awful air, as much as we can, which frankly we should be doing anyway with this pandemic, just staying inside and staying away from others. So staying kind of in our households, which I think most of us have been doing. The first part of your question is a little bit harder to answer because the thing is we just don't know what this pollution, all this smoke, how it interacts with the coronavirus. The speculation, the assumption is it can't be good. It certainly isn't a positive thing. The data that we have on what smoke pollution, how it interacts with respiratory illnesses points to, that we could see, a complication of cases that people who are susceptible to serious illness, this may kind of make them more susceptible, that we could see an uptick in cases related to sort of, damage to the lungs, damage to the respiratory, and the coronavirus. It could just make it easier for people to get sick and make them get sicker. But to be honest, we just don't know. We don't know how much, this kind of pollution for this extended period of time, it might affect that. I think the other bigger issue is, everybody's sort of coughing and sneezing more and running eyes. That stuff leads to more transmission potentially. So that's sort of like a secondary issue. And the fact that, people are scared. So if you aren't feeling well, if you have symptoms of, respiratory illness, if you're coughing, if you're wheezing, that kind of thing, you may be more likely are going to seek care. And that puts, a strain on our hospitals that are really trying to reduce that strain in these pandemic times.
So it's yet another challenge for us to deal with on top of
exactly.
Shelter. It definitely feels like things are piling up. But you mentioned, obviously, we should stay indoors. But for those who do have to leave for whatever reason, in terms of mask wearing, from what I understand, N95 masks, which don't completely prevent the spread of coronavirus, are the preferred masks to filter out smoky air. So what would you tell listeners about what masks to wear?
So I would say if you are somebody who has to work outside, your job is in construction, is in some sort of activity that requires you to be outside in the poor air for long periods of time, then you should talk to your employer. You should, you should try to find one of those N95s because those really are the only thing that do the trick. There are a few big caveats at that. The number one being, of course, that we need to really preserve those masks for our healthcare workers, people that are, in those healthcare settings who really need them to protect themselves and their patients from the coronavirus. And as people are well aware by now, there is a kind of shortage of these masks. So it's not like we want everybody going out and getting those. And frankly, if you don't have reason to be out, and if you're just going to the store, if you're even just going for, you know, a walk down the block, maybe you just need to get outside for 5 or 10 minutes to not breathe fresh air, but to breathe something other than the inside of your home. You shouldn't be pulling out an N95 for that. You should just, you know, be wearing the mask you would ordinarily wear, which doesn't help with the smoke, but you know, we got to be preserving these N95s is what it comes down to.
All right. Well, I appreciate your update on that second plague that's affecting the Bay Area. Hopefully we don't have locusts anytime soon, or who knows
what right.
plague might be coming our way. But let's go back to the original plague that we were all dealing with, which is coronavirus. And as I mentioned, today is the first day under these new reopening guidelines. So can you tell us what businesses got the green light to serve customers indoors?
Yeah, so we finally had quite a few businesses that people have been eagerly anticipating reopening, including hair salons, barbershops, gyms open for the first time for indoor service. And we're talking specifically San Francisco, by the way. So, you know, a lot of these places that have been basically shut down since the very beginning are now finally able to conduct business indoors. And I know that people, you know, are super excited about that. A few of these businesses had been allowed to do some very limited outdoor activities, but frankly, you know, in San Francisco, there aren't a lot of people or places that want to get a haircut outside, or that, you know, it's, and obviously with the air quality, the way it's been, it's not real convenient to be doing anything outside. So, you know, definitely there's a lot of relief that there's a return to some of these indoor businesses. And I think it says a lot about how our understanding of the coronavirus has changed. And we've recognized that, in fact, you can do these things safely indoors as long as you take a lot of, you know, precautions, which aren't that hard to do. It's, you know, wearing masks and keeping, you know, the number of people indoors very limited. So the capacity is limited. But it seems that as long as you take these precautions at these activities, you know, people can go out and do them pretty safely.
So I guess if Nancy Pelosi had gone to her hair salon today, that would have been okay. It just wasn't okay when she went in there.
Correct.
So the new timeline was just announced on Thursday. And were businesses actually ready to open their doors today?
No, it happened actually pretty quickly. And so my understanding was that there wasn't complete guidance on how they should do it. It didn't come until later this afternoon, but there was some initial guidance. So some places felt comfortable doing it right as of, you know, first thing this morning, but a lot of others were kind of slowly doing it throughout the day. And generally, as businesses have reopened throughout this whole entire process since last May, even there's usually been kind of a slow, most businesses feel most comfortable doing kind of a slow unrolling, kind of figuring out how best to do these guidelines. You know, there's a lot of kind of figuring out how these practices work. You know, how do you set up kind of and control capacity? You know, if you're doing a hair salon, you know, what does that look like? How many, you know, where do you put customers who show up early for an appointment? What do you do if somebody shows up without a mask? I mean, they're just things that they have to think about that, you know, kind of, it's a kind of learn as you go. But I think we'll see, you know, most of these places that will reopen again that are able to.
It is pretty amazing to see the way people have been able to adapt to the virus over the last 6 months. And I know that indoor museums, galleries, and schools all have to follow a special process. Can you tell us what that looks like?
Well, I mean, it really depends a lot on the individual operation. But it does boil down to kind of just the basics, which is, you know, really universal masking and social distancing, and just depending on the location, just making sure that people really keep that distance, making sure that they're kept separate. In schools, you know, there's the big topic of cohorting, keeping them in these small groups so that it limits spread. And if you do get a case, it's easier to get on top of it. So, you know, some of these things, again, they're kind of basic, but I think in practice, they can be a little bit more complicated to figure out. You know, how do you keep school children apart during, you know, outdoor activity? How do you kind of make sure that this sort of social distance is maintained among young people and also in public spaces. But, you know, obviously some of these things are opening again because we believe that we can do it. We believe we have the knowledge and the resources now to be able to figure that out.
Certainly don't envy teachers trying to keep the kids, school kids apart.
No, definitely not.
Is there any indication as to when there would be more widespread opening of schools, you know, throughout the Bay Area?
I don't think so. I think that the impression I get is there are lots of schools that won't really reopen in any kind of large capacity potentially for the rest of the year. it's, you know, there's a lot of variants, and I think, you know, everybody's sort of waiting to see how low we can get the sort of community transmission down. So how effective we are with this, you know, kind of second attempt at reopening. And, you know, I think if we can get community transmission down real low to even where we were, you know, back in March or April when we were doing kind of our first round of shelter in place, then that would make people feel pretty comfortable that we can get kids back into school and not risk, you know, major outbreaks. But frankly, you know, as long as we're still seeing pretty significant transmission, which we still are, even though it's looking a lot better, we're not ready to take that risk. And I don't know that anybody feels confident that we're going to see a big change in that anytime real soon.
I guess you could say since the adults didn't do our homework on the virus, the kids are not going to be able to go back to school.
I mean,
do their homework.
That's frankly true. I mean, it's, you know, it's because we kind of misbehaved and didn't wear masks and we had parties that were not. I mean, it's literally those two are connected.
And we've all been told to go to our rooms as a punishment.
Yes.
So in terms of the opening here, the reopening, and at least in San Francisco, can you give us some indication of what led to that change? Is it the result of San Francisco actually doing better on the data, or is this more just in response to the economic pressures?
I think it's actually more on the data side. I think that San Francisco has been pretty resistant to the economic pressures all along. I mean, certainly they feel it, and certainly there is, you know, much interest among political leaders to reopen businesses, not even so much because of pressures, but just because they recognize that this is that it's its own health risk to have people, you know, not able to work, not able to have kids go to school, all of that stuff. We need to be able to resume some of that activity just to kind of keep people healthy even. So there is that sort of, you know, understanding. But really, yes, this reopening is happening, I think, you know, on a speeded up basis for two reasons. One, because the numbers are looking better. And to be honest, you know, San Francisco never really experienced even the degree of surge that a lot of the rest of the state did. So even though we certainly saw a big increase in cases and in hospitalizations, it still wasn't as dramatic as other places. So we've always been, you know, kind of in better shape than much of the rest of the state and the country. But on top of that, you know, it's like I said before, we, I think, have a much better understanding now and appreciation for what kinds of activities are safe, or at least what kinds of activities we can make safe. So recognizing that, yes, you can do things indoors, you can have massages, you can have tattoo parlors and hair salons, as long as you take these, honestly, fairly simple precautions. It's not like this stuff is super hard either. So I think, you know, we have figured that out over the past few months, and that's why there's a lot more confidence that we can do more of these activities now.
Well, one of these activities is one that, you know, many people enjoy and are looking forward to doing more of, is just eating at restaurants. But last week we heard about the results of a CDC study that indicated that adults who contracted COVID-19 were twice as likely to have eaten at restaurants, both indoors or outdoors. And so I'm curious, Aaron, if you can tell us what the fallout from that report has been, if any. Are there any signs that dining out is going to become even more limited than it already is?
I don't think it'll become more limited based on that report. I think that report certainly was concerning to a lot of folks, but it does have some pretty big caveats, which is one of which is it didn't differentiate between indoors and outdoors very well. The other being that it was an association and not, you know, we don't know that those people got sick at a restaurant or because they were there. They could have been doing other activities that were putting them at risk. But that being said, it is one more piece of evidence, and we already had evidence of spread, especially with indoor dining. So it's not super surprising. And already, you know, most of the Bay Area has been very hesitant to do, you know, allow any sort of indoor dining anytime. I kind of put it, frankly, on the same timeline almost as schools, not that they're the same thing at all. But to me, it seems likely that we will see sort of a resumption of indoor dining, widespread anyway, once and if we can get that community transmission down to a really low and really manageable level. And we're just not there yet.
And in terms of data that would maybe make San Francisco kind of slip backwards, we have a new state color-coded system where San Francisco's in the red, or otherwise known as a substantial zone. So what factors might cause our county to move either up or down in that ranking, and might change what can be open in terms of businesses?
So the factors are actually pretty simple now, which is nice. There's two main factors as of the moment, and one is the percent, or sorry, the number of new cases, the rate of new cases per 100,000 residents, and then the other is this positivity rate that the governor talks about. So the percent of coronavirus tests coming back positive. And on both fronts, San Francisco's pretty solidly in this third tier, this red tier. I think it's third, maybe it's second. I need to get those correct, but there's four tiers, and it's in the second highest tier. You know, I think it's probably, given the trend in San Francisco, is probably more likely that we would trend down into the next tier than move up into that purple kind of top tier. But that's, you know, that remains to be seen. You know, we've had a lot of events in the last few weeks that could potentially lead to an increase in transmission. A lot of chaos from the fires, you know, the smoke pollution. We had Labor Day where people may have been getting together in groups. So that could potentially lead to another uptick in cases. Or it frankly could go the other direction where, because of all these events, people have actually been huddled down at home, you know, hunkered down at home more often, and will actually see a further decrease in spread because of that. That's the nature of this pandemic. It's so much is on human behavior. And as we all know, human behavior can be very unpredictable.
And Aaron, I wanted to ask you, in terms of the businesses that are open now, were any of them a surprise to you that the county or maybe the state has allowed some of these businesses to open? And I guess maybe another way of asking that is, are there any particular activities that you think are particularly high risk or higher risk of the ones that are open today?
I don't think so. I think that given sort of, you know, what we've learned about this virus, it didn't seem too surprising to me that these businesses were selected to reopen. I know that, you know, things like nail salons, even hair salons, you know, back in May, when we were still kind of feeling our way through this reopening, there was a lot of concern that those businesses would be very high risk because it involves a lot of really close contact, right? You're right in somebody's face. But, you know, I think in the time since then, we've realized that masks are incredibly effective as long as both people are wearing them. And so those businesses really aren't as high risk as we thought. And we figured that out over these last few months. And so I think for the most part, I mean, I will say San Francisco, Dr. Colfax and Dr. Aragon, the health officer, have been very conservative in their reopening approach. And so to me, the fact that they're allowing this to happen says that they, you know, that makes me feel pretty secure, honestly.
And last question for you, Aaron. I know as a health reporter, you've been busy covering COVID and now, of course, the smoky air, as we were talking about. But are there any other health stories that you're following these days?
That is an excellent question. You know, there are a lot of health stories going on that I have just been, frankly, not able to even keep up on. I'm about to dive into stem cells again because, you know, the stem cell initiative is going to be back on the ballot in November. So that's, frankly, would have been a really big story for me this year, covering, you know, the future of stem cell funding in California. But it's really been sort of backburnered because, you know, everything has been around the pandemic and then now the fires.
Well, I know you've got your plate full, and we really appreciate you coming on, Aaron. Thanks so much for joining us. That's Aaron Alday, health reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. Thanks so much,
Thanks
Aaron.
Again for having me.
All right. And next up, we'll be hearing from a supporter and an opponent of a different ballot measure on this November's ballot, Prop 15. So stay with us on City Visions. Well, welcome back to City Visions. I hope you're looking forward to our upcoming discussion about Proposition 15 to reform California property taxes on business property. Tonight's show is one of several this fall that will delve into a specific ballot issue with knowledgeable guests who can explain the nuances of the measures and answer your questions. This November is a critical election, not just at the national level, but right here in the Bay Area. And that's why we're dedicating time and resources to topics that matter to you. If you value these illuminating conversations and fact-based news to keep you informed, consider making a donation tonight by calling 1-800-525-9917 or online at kalw.org. Tonight, we're talking politics, but KALW offers the same kind of thoughtful journalism around the pandemic, arts, the environment, and really any subject that touches the lives of those in our community. KALW is your local source for what you need now. And if you're able to find what you need by tuning in, please consider making a donation to the station. Here at KALW, we keep our fundraising campaign short so that we can minimize the interruption to the programming that you love. Give us a call at 1-800-525-9917. And you can go online to KALW.org. And as I mentioned at the opening, we have $1,500 in matching funds from our producer's circle for this hour. That means that if you donate, we will match up to the first $1,500. If you've been listening to KALW for years and always meant to give, don't wait. Now is the time. And if you're a new listener, show us how happy you are that you are tuning in by making a donation. Any contribution helps if you're able to do so. And you can also become a sustaining member for as little as $5 per month. We need your support to help us keep the shows you love on the air. And here on City Visions, we're committed to providing you with the information you need to make an informed vote in November. And in return, we're asking that you vote for public radio by making a contribution to KALW today. So go online to KALW.org or call 800-525-9917. That's 800-525-9917. And we will match your donations this hour up to $1,500. Thanks so much for listening. And thanks for your support. So now we're going to go back to our regular City Visions programming here on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm your host, Ethan Elkind. Now, with the election drawing nearer, tonight we are taking a look at Prop 15, which has been called the Split Roll Initiative on property tax collection here in California. And it's an amendment, a proposed amendment to the 1978 landmark Proposition 13. Now, supporters say it will provide $12 billion in revenue to California's struggling public schools and eliminate a tax loophole for large corporations. But opponents say it is a deliberate weakening of Prop 13 and its important taxpayer protections in an already overtaxed state. So do you know what the split roll means? Do you feel Prop 13 should be amended? And has the outlook for this proposition changed in light of the economic fallout from COVID-19? We're going to discuss and unpack all of the complexity of Prop 15 tonight, joined by Susan Shelley, columnist and member of the editorial board for the Southern California News Group and vice president of communications for the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association. Welcome to City Vision, Susan.
Thank you very much. Great to be with you.
And we're also joined by Ben Grief, campaign director and spokesperson for Evolve California, which organizes grassroots campaigns in support of middle-class and center-left Californians. Welcome, Ben.
Thanks so much for having me this evening.
And we also want to hear from you. We'll open the phone lines up in just a few minutes. But if you want to call and ask questions about Prop 15 or your opinions on Prop 13 and ask questions of the panel, you can do so by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-TALK-TALK. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org. Or you can tweet us at City Visions KALW. So let's first talk, when we're talking about Prop 15, about Prop 13. You can't talk about one without talking about the other. Prop 13, as I mentioned, was the landmark Tax Protection Act that was passed in 1978 as an amendment to our Constitution. And Prop 15 now seeks to amend Prop 13. So Susan Shelley, let me start with you. Can you just remind us why Prop 13 was passed in the first place and what problem it was addressing?
Sure. Well, in the 1970s, property was appreciating very rapidly in value. And at the time, property taxes were based on a market rate assessment. So the county assessors would judge the market value of a property, and the average tax rate in California was 2.67% of the market value of your house every year. So imagine 2.67% of the market value of your house every year as a condition of keeping it. And as prices were going up in the real estate market, people were literally being taxed out of their own property, not just homeowners, but also business owners. Just the property tax bill would come at the beginning of the year and people couldn't pay it. And the legislature didn't do anything about it. And there was a signature campaign to get Prop 13 on the ballot. And it passed with nearly 2/3 of the vote.
And so how did Prop 13 change then how properties are assessed now in California?
Well, under Proposition 13, when you buy a piece of property, as long as the ownership doesn't change, it can only go up in assessed value a maximum of 2% per year. So the longer you hold your property, if the real estate market is surging up and it's going up 10% a year, you're still only going to have your assessed value go up 2% a year. And so this creates stability, not just for the property owner, but also for the government, because they don't get these big spikes and then declines and spikes and declines in revenue. It just climbs steadily and predictably, which is really a good thing in California because the other tax revenue streams are pretty volatile.
And Ben Grief, let me go to you. Now, we just heard from Susan an overview of Prop 13 and why it was passed. Why are people now trying to dismantle it?
So the first thing I would say is no one's trying to dismantle Prop 13. What Prop 15 does is a real common sense solution to closing a corporate loophole in our 42-year-old property tax law that most folks don't even know exists. You know, Prop 15 really strengthens protections for residential property by, you know, exempting any type of residential property at all. You know, we've seen ads starting to come out from the No on 15 campaign that are basically just lies and scare tactics, trying to get people to think that somehow this would remotely affect their home at all, which, again, completely lie, complete scare tactic. This initiative also exempts agriculture property. What we're working to do is simply put California on par with how the rest of the country taxes large commercial properties. I'd also add that this common sense initiative exempts all commercial and industrial property that's valued at less than $3 million. So really, this is not any kind of dismantling at all from the homeowner protections, you know, all homes, apartments, you know, assisted living facilities, live workspaces, you know, mobile homes, anything like that, you name it, will not be affected by this. This will only put our state on par with how the rest of the country tax larger commercial properties valued over $3 million.
And Ben, your organization, Evolve California, it's been working to change Prop 13 for a number of years now. Why haven't those efforts worked so far? And why do you and others in your organization think that it will be different this time?
Well, this is something that we've been working toward for quite some time because, you know, the reality of the situation is most people don't realize that Prop 13 has this huge corporate loophole. You know, when people think about Prop 13, they think, oh, yeah, this is something to keep me in my home. You know, when it passed overwhelmingly in 1978, it was really about keeping grandma in their home. But our campaign over the years to educate folks, and we're really excited about the opportunity we have now in November to finally close this loophole, has always been about, you know, the idea that Chevron doesn't need the same protections as grandma. And that's all this common sense initiative is working to do.
And Susan, let me go back to you. You talked about the origins of Prop 13 in the 70s, 1978. What is support like now for Prop 13 versus what it was like in the late 70s? I mean, as Ben mentioned, at the time in the 70s, it was about grandma. And now, is that still the case? Or is this argument around commercial properties being in a different situation gaining any traction?
As I understand it, Prop 13 has always had about two-thirds support in California for the 40-some years that it's been in effect. And this is no loophole. This is not a loophole. In 1978, there was another measure that was put on the ballot as a competitor by the legislature and by then-Governor Brown, and it would have allowed a split roll. And the voters turned it down, 53-47. They absolutely knew that they were including commercial property in Proposition 13, which had always been the case in California. Going back to the 1800s, the state has always had a unified property tax roll, all properties taxed, same rates, same rules, regardless of how they were used. So what this does is it starts to look at, well, what are you doing with your property? Are you this kind of a business? Are you that kind of a business? If you're an agricultural land, well, you get an exemption. If you're a home-based business, you get an exemption. It's very easy once you start down this path to start rewriting the exemptions. Oh, well, a home-based business with X number of dollars of revenue is a big business, and we're going to pull the exemption. That's the logical next step. So though this measure doesn't do that, once you go down this path, which we've never done in California in all of its history, of looking at how the property is used in order to figure out what the tax rate is and what the assessed value is, once you go down that path, it's an endless walk toward higher taxes.
So Susan, you bring up a number of the potential accounting and other details that I do want to get into. But I first just want to ask you about the current tax environment that Prop 15 would change. So in terms of the commercial property taxes that are paid now, can you tell us who is paying most of those taxes? And also, what has been the change in relative taxes from commercial versus residential owners since Prop 13 passed?
Well, it depends on how many more residential properties there are in California. I believe the legislative analyst looked at that issue and said that it's not because of Prop 13, it's because of more residential property being constructed as opposed to commercial, that the residential property is a higher percentage of the taxes collected. But the big problem, one of the big problems with Proposition 15 is that while it says it's trying to protect small businesses that rent their space have no protection at all. And most standard commercial leases are triple net, which means the tenant pays the property taxes and the insurance and the maintenance. So if Westfield, the mall company, or the Simon Mall company, or the owner of a little strip mall gets reassessed, all those little tenants get reassessed. And it's going to be a brutal increase in costs for small businesses that are already struggling.
And I mentioned this is sometimes called the split roll initiative. Can you explain for listeners what split roll means and how it's being used here in this context? And if you can listen to me, if you can hear me, wanted to ask you if you can describe what split roll means.
I'm sorry, was that a question to me?
Yes.
I apologize. I thought you were asking Susan. You know, what we're talking about doing is maintaining all residential property tax protections that we currently have in place and just eliminating these protections for large commercial property owners. You know, I think it's interesting, you know, with all due respect to Susan, she spent a lot of time talking about, oh, well, you know, if this happens, then maybe this could happen at some time down the road. And that's just preposterous, right? You know, we both agree 2/3 of Californians totally support Prop 13. They support the homeowner and residential property tax protections, but they don't support the idea that, you know, Disneyland is still paying property taxes based on land values in 1970s. You know, that Chevron is saving over $100 million every year because of this loophole. And, you know, if we're taking a trip down memory lane, we should really look at the 2 years after Prop 13 passed in California. There were 43 pieces of copycat legislation that passed all across the country, but not one of them included protections for commercial property, because that doesn't make any sense, right? If you were fortunate enough to own commercial property, then you were fortunate enough to pay your fair share of property taxes. And what Prop 15 does is just require that large commercial property owners, you know, like your Disney's, like your Chevron's, like your Sultan of Brunei, who owns 2 Beverly Hills hotels and is undertaxed by $6 million a year, that those folks pay property taxes based on fair market value. But Prop 15 does not change the property tax rate that California has in place. It will maintain the 1% property tax rate, which, by the way, is one of the lowest in the country. All we're working to do is put our state on par with what Texas does, with what Oklahoma does, with what Florida does, with what New York does, and pretty much every other place in the country. So the idea that this is some, you know, bizarre radical idea that you know, we couldn't possibly do is completely fallacious. This is just common sense right down the middle to put our state on par with what everyone else does.
Well, if you're just joining us, this is City Visions on KALW 91.7 FM. We're talking about Prop 15 on the ballot this November right here in California, and it would create a split roll initiative to reform how property taxes are collected on commercial properties. And we're joined by Susan Shelley, columnist and member of the editorial board for the Southern California News Group and vice president of communications for the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association, and also joined by Ben Grief, campaign director and spokesperson for Evolve California, which organizes grassroots campaigns in support of middle-class and center-left Californians. Well, Susan, let me go to you on Ben's points about some of these big corporations that are getting a pretty big tax benefit from the commercial property tax protections of Prop 13. What do you say to these arguments that it's Disneyland, it's Chevron, it's as was mentioning? What's your response to
Well, what I would say to that is that it's not just Chevron and Disneyland. It's wherever anybody works. It's any private company where people work. It's any supermarket where people shop. It's any mall that's trying to keep the retail businesses in business instead of losing business to Amazon.com and other places out of the state. This is going to raise the cost of living in California, which is already, if you look at the cost of living in California and you take it into account, we have the highest poverty rate in the country. And this is going to raise prices. How could it not raise prices if you raise the costs of operating for every business in the state? And not just once, but every 3 years, these businesses will be reassessed to market value. So let's assume that the economy recovers and that their property values rise and everybody wants to be doing well. You've got this giant tax increase sitting out there on the horizon for every business property owner. How much money is it even going to bring in? You know, the California Assessors Association called it impossible to implement because of the way that the various exceptions and exemptions are written. And so we don't really know what a hotel is worth in the post-COVID era, or an office building or a restaurant. So who knows how much money it's going to bring in? And this is why I think it's a concern about what's the next step, because all of these needs will not be met by what they say the revenue is going to be. This is a step down the road toward higher taxes.
Well, and Susan, there's one interesting feature of commercial property ownership, and I think Ben was getting at this, which is that if a company sells the company itself, if, in other words, if someone's trying to buy that property, they can essentially do a corporate buyout, and then ownership never technically changes hands. So what do you say to arguments that that's not fair, because that can't happen on the residential side, but it is a way for companies to essentially get around having to have their property reassessed if they don't actually change hands, but instead buy out the company itself that owns it?
Well, the definition of change of ownership is not in Proposition 13. That's in statute. That's in a law, in the Revenue Code, which can be changed. And Senator Patricia Bates has proposed this multiple times. And the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association supports that, clarifying and changing the definition of change of ownership to prevent some of these deals from getting around what is clearly a change of ownership, but they get around the fact because of the definition. That can be changed without changing the Constitution. It can certainly be changed without raising taxes. This is the biggest property tax increase in the history of the state.
Ben Grief, I wanted to talk about the revenue that would be raised. Susan mentioned it might be uncertain, but what is the plan under Prop 15 for where the increased tax revenue would go?
Sure. I'd first like to respond to a few things that Susan mentioned. I think the most important thing to remember is this is not a uniform tax increase on all businesses or all commercial properties even. You know, in fact, 92% of the estimated up to $12 billion revenue that Prop 15 will bring in is coming from just 10% of commercial properties in California. And if you think about it, that makes sense, because most commercial properties are paying at or near market value property taxes. It's only a small number of large commercial property owners, you know, the Chevrons and the Disneys and the Transamerica Pyramids of the world, that are not paying their fair share because they haven't been, you know, there hasn't been a change of ownership in quite some time. But most commercial properties are paying their fair share. You know, think of all the tech companies. You know, I brought up Transamerica Pyramid to juxtapose it with the Salesforce Tower. You know, the Salesforce Tower, the job creators of today and tomorrow are paying their fair share. So they're not benefiting from this loophole that only benefits legacy commercial property owners. So I think that's really an important thing to mention. The other thing that I really want to mention is over the last 40 years, we've lost $150 billion from this corporate loophole in Prop 13, right? And what has that meant? Well, that means that the burden of taxation has shifted to individuals, right? And that is a big problem. And that's something that we desperately need to address. Right now, we have a situation where we are being nickeled and dimed year after year just to provide the minimum standard of education, of filling our potholes, of for our parks, our roads, and our libraries, for our emergency services and first responders. And if we continue to be an outlier in this country and not tax large commercial property owners at fair market value, we will continue to have to nickel and dime individuals and small business owners and working families and homeowners and renters and everyone else. It's indefensible, which is why I feel like, you know, Shelley keeps going back to, oh, what if, what if, what if? Let's just talk about the policy that we have in front of us. This would put us on par with what the rest of the country does. It has exemptions for properties under $3 million. And also, it provides the largest tax break for small businesses in a generation. Prop 15, in addition to having large commercial property owners pay fair market value and property taxes, it also eliminates the first $500,000 of taxation on personal business equipment. And for folks that aren't familiar with that is, if you're a restaurant owner and you have to pay this tax every year, you have to count up all your tables, your chairs, your forks, your knives, your pots, pans, ovens, refrigerators, and you have to pay a tax on that. That's a perfect example of a tax that California, of course, has and requires nickel and diming of individuals to make up for this loss of billions of dollars coming from some of the largest commercial property owners that we have in California. That doesn't make any sense, right? So to be against Prop 15 is not only to be against sort of fair taxation, but it's also to be against the largest tax break for small businesses in a generation. So, you know, what we're talking about here is just common sense, fair and balanced, putting our state on par with what everyone else does without increasing taxes on individuals, on homeowners or renters, which is what is going to happen, especially after the where we are with this pandemic. Where do you think we're going to get the money from if we don't do this? Right? We're going to get it from individuals.
And on the revenue side, where would Prop 15 dedicate the increase?
Oh, yeah, excellent. So 40% of the revenue is dedicated to our K through 12 schools and community colleges, which pre-pandemic were already 39th in the nation in education funding, which for being in the fifth largest economy in the world, we should be ashamed of that. That's horrific.
And the other 60%
goes to cities, counties, and special districts. And I want to highlight special districts for a moment, because one of the special districts this will be going to is fire districts. This will provide $390 million per year to our fire districts. And right now, what we're all going through, I think we can all 100% agree that we need more money for our fire districts. And if we don't do this, then we're not going to be putting ourselves in as safe a position as we would be. This is critical to not only our schools, not only to our public services in cities, but also to our fire safety.
Right. Well, this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco. We're talking about Prop 15, which would reform Prop 13 and how it assesses commercial properties over a certain value. If you have any questions or comments about Prop 15, we'd love to hear from you. Please do give us a call at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send an email to cityvisions@kalw.org or find us on Twitter. We're at cityvisionskalw. Well, it is our fall pledge drive, and City Visions has been covering Bay Area issues and culture since 1991. That's almost 30 years of conversations with politicians, journalists, jurists, environmentalists, authors, activists, and scholars. And if you're a longtime City Visions listener, you may have noticed that in recent months, we've tweaked our format to meet these complex times. What used to be one long segment with a panel of guests has now morphed into three segments, although tonight we're doing two segments because it is the fall pledge drive. We start most weeks with a shorter news update, whether it be the latest on the coronavirus, as you heard with Aaron Alday, updates on the movement for racial justice, or more recently, news about the wildfires. And we close most weeks with an art segment, although we won't have time for arts tonight. But over these last months, we've spoken with authors, musicians, poets, artists, comedians, and we hope that you like this new format. We also hope that the news keeps you informed and that the art segment provides some calm in what has most definitely not been a very calming time recently. Now, this ability of our show to adapt to circumstances to provide listeners like you with what you need is precisely why I'm asking you to support KALW today. Whether you keep the radio tuned to KALW all day long or listen to the podcast on demand, please consider making a contribution if you can afford to. Give us a call, 800-525-9917. That's 800-525-9917, or go online to kalw.org. As I mentioned, we have $150 in matching funds from our producer circle for this hour. So if you call in or go online to donate, we will be able to match up to $1,500. Let's see if we can take advantage of that full match. So during these times, I think public radio is more important than ever, and that's why I'm asking you to really consider how much you're able to give. number, ask yourself if you can stretch it just a little bit further. Public radio has never been more important, and we hope you agree. So please do consider helping shows like City Visions adapt and thrive by donating at klw.org or by calling 800-525-9917. That's 800-525-9917. All right, and this is City Visions. We are very excited tonight to be talking about Prop 15 to reform Prop 13. And we're joined by Susan Shelley, Vice President of Communications for the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association, and Ben Grief, Campaign Director and Spokesperson for Evolve California. As I mentioned, we'd love to hear from you with your calls for our guest tonight, 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-TALK. Or you can also email us, cityvisions@klw.org. Or we're on Twitter at City Visions KALW. And it's on Twitter where we got a tweet from Dan who says, as a public school teacher, it is disgraceful that I have to pay out of pocket every year for basic supplies while my district calls for volunteers to sew masks because of budget shortfalls. Unacceptable, while the likes of Chevron pockets hundreds of millions of dollars every year. He says yes on 15. And then he follows up with, there is just no justification for educators having to reach out to families for donations. They pay their taxes while golf courses have evaded reassessment and paying their fair share for years. So Susan Shelley, what's your response to an educator like Dan with that tweet?
There's a lot of money in California that goes to education. And if you look at the inflation-adjusted per-pupil spending on the government's website from the Department of Education, you can see that it's gone up since the 1970s from about 5,000-something to about 11,000-something in the most recent years. So inflation-adjusted, there's more spending per pupil. There's a question about what that money is being spent on, what the priorities are. He's absolutely right that teachers should not be reaching into their pocket. Talk to the Board of Education, talk to the legislature, see where that money is going. That's more important than what those teachers are buying.
And Ben, I wanted to ask you about a point Susan made about the difficulty potentially of accounting for a different property tax rate for commercial properties versus residential properties. So what do you make of Susan's arguments? What about these accounting challenges? I mean, is that going to be a problem for implementation?
No, absolutely not. That's just another lie, another scare tactic. I'm sorry. If the rest of the country can do this, I'm sure we in California, especially, you know, in the Bay Area and Silicon Valley, can figure out how to do it as well. That's just completely a non-issue. I think what we should be talking about is what people like Dan are saying. You know, why is it that New York State spends $22,000 a year per student, where California spends about $12,000 per year? How are we going to move forward as a state, as a society, when we are not spending the appropriate funding for our young people? That's really what we should be thinking about. But I also want to mention something that Susan mentioned about what price is going up, which is, again, another lie, another scare tactic. You know, right here in San Francisco, we have dozens of examples of gas stations right across the street from one another. One I want to bring up, it's at 19th and Judah. We've done a lot of analysis on this. The Chevron station is charging $3.50 for gas. The station across the street is charging $3.11 for gas. Now, if this was trickling down to us, then wouldn't Chevron's gas be less expensive? No. You know, but Chevron is paying about $15 per square foot in property taxes, while the competitor, who again has cheaper gas, is paying $124 per square foot. That doesn't make any sense. This isn't trickling down. What this is currently is an anti-competitive policy. And the things that have made California so great are education and entrepreneurship. But what this loophole does is squash both, right? We have a situation where if you are someone who wants to purchase a commercial property across from someone who's owned their commercial property for decades, you're at a competitive disadvantage. And that doesn't make any sense. Really what that is the very definition of government regulation of the free market. That gives one business a leg up, while the newer business that we need in California to continue to build our economy, and it was what made us so great and made us the fifth largest economy in the world, we need them to thrive, and we should be having policies that level the playing field, right? This is why they don't have this policy in the rest of the country, because it just doesn't make any sense.
Well, let's go to the phone lines now. We have Ted from San Francisco dialing in. So Ted, welcome to City Visions.
Hi, this is a question for Susan. curious in the context where we clearly undertaxed some properties in the state and we clearly need more revenue, what are alternatives to this proposition?
All right. Thank you, Ted, for that. Susan, go ahead.
I think we've all seen in this pandemic that when businesses are hurt, revenue drops to the state budget. We have seen revenue crater, sales tax revenue, income tax revenue. Texas doesn't have an income tax, but California does. We don't do everything the way Texas does it. And there's no plan here to reduce any of the other taxes that are so-called nickel and diming us. There's no plan here on the table to cut any of those taxes. This is just a flat tax increase on businesses. So what happens to the supermarket? What happens to the mall? What happens to the office building when you raise the taxes? It's easy to say the prices won't go up. I'm not so sure there's anything to support that statement. And the thing that would help revenue in California is more business growth. The reverse of what we've just had in the pandemic. Policies that encourage business growth will produce more revenue. You get more with lower tax burdens than you do with higher tax burdens.
All right. Well, thank you, Ted, for that question. And I want to address an email that came in from Ken in Mill Valley, who says he has a question for Ben. He says, can you talk about the market efficiency argument for split roll? A commercial broker in San Francisco told Ken that the cavernous bus van for bargains building has been vacant for nearly two decades because the owners have very little carrying costs, having paid the mortgage a long time ago and having a property tax bill that's locked at a low rate under Prop 13. The net result is a vacant building, homeless people sleeping on the stoop, and it's been vacant for nearly two decades. Ben, did you want to respond to Ken's email? And I can let Susan weigh in as well.
Yeah, I definitely would. And I'm glad Ken brings that up. But really quickly, I just want to talk about Susan mentioned the supermarkets. Again, there is no evidence whatsoever, and we have looked extensively because we've been working on this issue for many, many years now, of property taxes affecting the price of goods and services. I brought up the Chevron example of how they're not passing down their tax savings to us in the price of gas. But also, you go to Trader Joe's. You know, there's no difference in the price of milk if you go to a Trader Joe's in one part of San Francisco or another, or in Oakland versus in Palo Alto or in Mill Valley or wherever it might be, because property taxes have absolutely no correlation to the price of goods and services, right? Because that's just the flat out. So again, it's a lie and it's a scare tactic. And I really welcome the opposition to find examples of a grocery store that's paying fair market value in property taxes and charging twice as much for the price of anything versus a grocery store that's paying decades old property taxes and charging decades old prices. It's just flat out not true. But to get to Ken's question, not only is the current system government regulation of the free market, but it also creates enormous inefficiencies, right? If we all see more and more, and this is pre-pandemic, mind you, we all see vacant storefronts in all of our communities. Because this provides a perverse incentive for commercial property owners to hold on to their land without actually needing to fill that space. Because if you're not paying fair market value in property taxes and you're paying property taxes based on 30-year-old assessments, there's no real reason to have someone rent it, to sell the property, or to develop it. And so we see blight all across California as a result of this. And that's something that this changes. Again, this is just common sense. This is just closing this loophole, creating more efficiencies in the market, which will better all of our communities, not just the additional revenue.
And Susan, let me direct Ken's emailed question to you as well. What do you make of this argument that Prop 13 has allowed a lot of commercial property owners to leave their properties vacant or generally underdeveloped because they don't have the forcing motivation of higher property taxes to encourage them to try to get more revenue out of the property?
Well, there's no reason that they would want to leave it vacant. There's no reason that leaving something vacant is a good idea. It may be that the carrying costs are low and they're trying to wait out a regulatory change or wait out a zoning change or wait out some other type of governmental action that's preventing them from building or developing the property. But it makes no sense that they want it to be vacant. So it's not Proposition 13 that's doing that. It's all these other governmental actions that are weighing on people in commercial real estate.
Susan, let me ask you about the impact of COVID. This has obviously scrambled things. A lot of people had plans for ballot initiatives, and then this pandemic hit. Do you see COVID scrambling politics here, Prop 15?
I would think it probably will have an effect because we're seeing businesses just struggling. Restaurants that can't open their dining rooms and office buildings where people are now working at home and people canceling their leases because they found out they can do this online and they don't need space anymore. So I think people have a new sense of how tough it is to stay in business in California. It's really difficult. You know, we have a difficult litigation climate. We have high taxes. We have a regulatory stranglehold on a lot of industries. It's difficult to do business in California. We have seen many businesses leave the state. And what will this do? What will it do when you have to look forward to see that you don't know what your property tax bill is going to be because you lose the certainty under Proposition 13, and now it's whatever the market is, you owe 1% of that value as a condition of keeping the property. Very destabilizing.
And so would that be your prediction that if Prop 15 passes, we would see businesses leaving the state?
I think so. I think they definitely will leave the state. They're already leaving the state. It's already tough to stay in business in California, and this would not make it easier.
And Ben, let me ask you the same question I just asked Susan, which is the impact of COVID. Has that scrambled what you've seen in terms of the debate around Prop 15 and people's sentiments around taxation and general economic activity in the state?
Well, you know, prior to COVID, this was a common sense fix to a broken property tax system. But now this initiative is honestly more important than ever. And I think that's why we have the endorsements of Mayor Breed, the entire Board of Supervisors, the school board in San Francisco, the Community College Board as well. We have the endorsements of Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, Bernie Sanders. And just on Friday, Governor Newsom came out to support this. And, you know, he called this a fair, phased in and long overdue reform to state tax policy. And that's exactly what this is, because we are facing unprecedented budget deficits here. Everywhere you look, we need revenue to get out of the current system situation that we're in. And this is the most common sense, fair, and balanced way to do that. So I think people are going to be looking at a situation where, okay, our teachers are spending their own money to keep things going. Our teachers are trying to figure out how do we do this in a COVID environment. You know, if we want to go back to school anytime soon, we need to make sure there's hot water and soap in our schools, which they're currently is not, right? This is a big problem top to bottom, and it's a common sense solution because it's not increasing taxes on homeowners, renters, or small businesses.
All right, well, we're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank you both so much for joining us for this debate on Prop 15. That was Susan Shelley, Vice President of Communications for the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association. Thank you, Susan.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
And I also want to thank Ben Grieve, campaign director and spokesperson for Evolve California. Thanks so much for joining us, Ben.
Thank you very much. Have a great evening.
So that's City Visions for this evening. For a link to this and other City Visions shows, you can visit the City Visions page on kalw.org. Our engineer tonight was Damian Miner, and tonight's show was produced by Chris Nooney and Wendy Holcomb. Join us again next Monday at 6 p.m. when we continue our election coverage with a closer look at Prop 16 and affirmative action. So tune in for that when we host it next week, Monday at 6 p.m. But before I sign off, I want to urge you again to support KALW during our fall membership campaign. 2020 has been a tough year for many of us, having to shelter in place, keep distance from friends and family in order to stay safe, and now having to stay inside because the air outside is unhealthy. It's easy to feel frustrated. And while we may not be able to solve some of these very pressing issues on our own, there is one thing we can do, and that is support the institutions we love. If you have been enjoying City Vision's focus on news, politics, and the arts, let us know by supporting the station that is keeping you apprised and giving local authors, artists, poets, musicians a platform when so many of the traditional venues for artists have been shut down. So if you want to hear more of these voices, and if you can afford it, please become a member, renew your membership, or add to your previous contribution by going online to kalw.org/donate or calling 800 800-525-9917. That's 800-525-9917. And as I mentioned at the top of the show and when I spoke to you earlier, but during this pledge drive, we do have a $1,500 matching Producer Circle gift that we will be able to match your donation. So today, when the world seems out of control, instead of feeling like there's nothing you can do, well, you can do this. Donate online at klw.org/donate or at 800-525-9917. Thanks so much. This is Ethan Elkind. I wish you a good night. Thanks for listening and stay safe.
This is KALW San Francisco at 91.7 FM and online at KALW.org.